What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Half 90 Podcast. And today we have returning guest Joe Jeffrey back on the podcast to talk about a pretty important topic. Last time we had him on talking about PEDs and their usage. And this time we're going to get a little bit more in depth, a little bit more specific, and talk about female drug use in the sport of bodybuilding. So Joe Jeffrey, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again, boys. I'm honored to be on so soon, and thank you to everybody that listened to the last episode. We got a really good reception on that. A lot of people sharing it to their stories, and a lot of DMs that it was helpful and the kind of thing people are looking for. So I thought that was brilliant, and hopefully this will be similar to women that have quite a minefield of information to pull from, not sure who to listen to or what to listen to. And if you don't have a great proclivity for reading literature, it's a difficult place to be as a woman in the PED world. So hopefully we'll clear that up a little bit today.
Yeah, and actually, that's exactly the reason I kind of wanted to have you back on so soon, is just because I think this is information that's not discussed on as publicly of a level as it needs to be in order for people to understand, like, what do we need to talk about in order for a coach to be able to manage this appropriately? And that's exactly the conversations that need to be had, in my opinion. So just to kick it off, main thing I want to kind of do is, what is like the initial conversation you're having to someone that's coming to you wanting to consider PED usage? The things you're going over, the considerations you need them to take. Obviously, we kind of went over the things you're checking in the last episode, so not too worried about that. If there's some other things specific to females, we can probably address. There's definitely a few that I do for sure. And we can kind of go down that route of the starting before we get into actual application.
Yeah, so maybe the only two things that jump to mind are, of course, now anybody that didn't listen to the last episode, you don't have to listen to the whole thing if you don't want to. Initially, we spoke about what you do, the kind of check boxes that you'd want to tick off before you started using drugs. That's all going to be the same. Maybe bar the staying on or coming off thing, because I suppose we could argue that you could revert to some kind of female HRT based thing, but it's not a requirement. I would also be interested what exogenous hormone use the female had already been subject to. Something many women don't realize is birth control, hormonal birth control is just exogenous hormone use, much like taking testosterone or whatever. I'd want to know their current status on that. What birth control was it? You know, because there's a very large difference between a Depo-Provera and a very low dose, maybe newer generation combination pill or something like this, and how that might interfere with PED use. Like a really basic example, where if you're taking a progestin-only pill and you've got an attenuation of estrogen and you're taking a non-aromatizing androgen, you know, you're leaving some things on the table. We'll talk a little bit more about estrogen as we go, I'm sure. But they're the main things that jump into my head. Luke, I'm pretty interested because you said there's some stuff that you would ask. What have I missed anything there?
No, so you kind of hit the main hitters of the normal individual consult that would come in. My issue is I get a lot of people that are in such a fatigue state from long-term, like, really low calorie usage, dieting, training overtraining, over cardioing, everything like that, that typically a lot of times I always on my consults ask for an initial blood work, whatever they have that they've already done. And I'll go fishing on some people for adrenal health and cortisol fluctuation throughout the day. And the only reason I say that is because I see it 10 times more in females than I do in males typically. Yeah. And that would be the only thing that typically jumps out to me in consults with females is occasionally going the route of like a Dutch test to see cortisol fluctuation throughout the day and see where they're at with that. But that'd be the only other thing that I typically come across.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's a great point on the Dutch test. Any sort of 24-year analysis of adrenal function is always useful, even just annually if you've got the funds for it, as well as echocardiogram, urinalysis, and blood work. Maybe they should be for everybody, you know, maybe not even gender specific. But yeah, great point. I think the only thing maybe worth mentioning, but I think we discussed it a little bit in the last podcast when we spoke about tapering your expectations. It's almost going to be the opposite with females in some respect, because, you know, I'll often have a consultation. Hey, you know, I'm in my first bikini show. I'm thinking about taking Anavar. You're going to go, hold on. There's a great degree of availability of other performance enhancing drugs to you that you don't need to go there, you know, just yet. So whereas if somebody come to me, you know, I'm looking to be the next national level physique competitor, it was going to be a different story, although we'd probably follow the same level of escalation as such. But you're not kind of planning, oh, how can we get away with X amount of androgen load over Y time with a bikini athlete, you know, or at least you shouldn't, which is probably the point of this podcast, right?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, that point that needs to be made. Honestly, for most bikini athletes, minus a few dietary-based compounds, like, I'm probably not going to be using really much of anything up the scaling. Like, I don't even think there needs to be a scaling for most bikini athletes, right? Like, we start getting into wellness and figure and physique, like, that scaling process is a lot more intense, right? But, like, on the level of bikini, like, I don't, other than maybe some things to help with the end of the dieting process when you're in a contest prep situation, there's not really much that I'm wanting to use with most individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And that's my thing. And I kind of wanted to touch on some of those things beforehand, because I think something that may have gotten glossed over in the last episode by our audience and not fully understanding what it is telmisartan and metformin, and just like the overall benefits of these two and how it's going to fit into the drug usage and the drug picking selection is kind of like the introductory steps of choosing things to phase these females in.
Yeah, so you've made a good point on telmisartan and metformin straight away. I'd quite like to, before we go there, maybe make an introduction into a safer use model for women, you could say. So we were talking about the safer use model last episode. I must clarify that really was for men. Pretty much the frameworks for men and women that you'd fit within a safer use model, they're essentially going to be the opposite in many respects. The first drugs that would come up for a man there are going to be like the last drugs for a woman. And this all principally comes back to the fact that they are androgen sensitive. We are not. I have no fear about a man using a moderate dose of testosterone. It's not something that concerns me. A female, absolutely, it's going to cause a ton of issues. It's not the safer use model. In the same way, if a man said to me, what do you think about me using Ostarine? I'd say there's absolutely no point. There's no reason for you to do that because you're not an androgen sensitive individual. A woman using Ostarine, yeah, you know, I can see the efficacy, you know, that huge divorce from androgenicity and the tissue selectivity. So, and even things like duration, I think moderate androgen use over long periods of time is probably the more efficient manner for men. I know a lot of people would disagree with that, fair enough. I think this is me personally speaking, I think that's the most efficient way to use. I think women, it's the total opposite. I think duration, in fact, I don't know what I'm saying, I think the evidence shows that within nandrolone, the evidence shows that the duration is way more important than the dose. And someone's listening going, oh, well, what if they took 1 milligram of nandrolone for 10 years or 1,000 milligrams of testosterone for 10 days? Without being silly about it, the duration is far more concerning for a woman. So you would be wiser to split things up in that way. So, you know, the framework I'm sort of painting here is that it really is going to be the opposite. And where we would start with women is essentially asking ourselves the question, what can we do that is non-androgenic, right? Whereas with men, it's like, hey, look, don't worry about it. Testosterone. And then maybe a steroidal SARM on top of that. That's probably all you're ever going to need to realize your goals in terms of anabolism. The anabolic toll required by a woman is far lower than a man. They're super sensitive. You know, they're androgen sensitive. So the milligram per kilograms that we would use for a man, they're going to be blown out the water for a woman. You know, anyway, telmisartan and metformin, both drugs that have excellent outcomes in terms of potential health benefits, safety, tolerability, deployed in humans, years of clinical data, more importantly, completely non-androgenic, right? So, I've sort of cut off here. You asked what telmisartan was, right?
What'd you say? I'm sorry.
Did you ask me, the listeners wanted to know what telmisartan was?
Yeah, just some of the further health benefits, like just like the lipid profile benefits and the blood glucose benefits, and obviously the blood pressures and ARB, but just like some of what those characteristics are, just because I don't think most people have been considering using it at all within a safer use model.
Yeah, so when I look at drugs, I'm always most interested by ones that have a multi-pronged effect, so to speak. Like if they can do many things that are useful for us, but they have great safety data, then I love that, right? So moderates blood pressure, brilliant. It's renal protective, great. Protective against dementia, great. It inhibits RAS system activation, therefore left ventricular wall heart protective, the cardioprotective. It decreases hematocrit. People are saying, I don't really give a shit about that stuff. You know, fair enough. It also decreases visceral fat. That's something that you're going to want. The thing that most people are interested in is that it's a PPAR agonist. That is peroxisome proliferator receptor agonist. This is the same thing that cardarine does, right? And this is where we see the increases in aerobic capacity. This is the mechanism by which it's going to decrease visceral fat. You get an improved glucose uptake to skeletal muscle tissue, potentially increases in HDL, decreases in LDL. For anyone that wants to dig a little deeper on a straight up comparison, telmisartan to cardarine, I've got one on my website. It's totally free. And we go through that on there, but that's what people here are most interested in. And here's an example of the safer use model in action. We've got a drug here that's completely non-androgenic. So I'm not worried about a female using this. It's deployed in females. In fact, a term I'd quite like to use here when we're looking at these drugs as we go down this tree is gender neutral. Probably quite apt with the political discussions we have these days. And also drugs that maybe are not sexually dimorphic. Growth hormone is. Maybe we can talk about that in a bit. So you look at this drug. Hey, look, it does this. It does it in men and women. And it's not going to drive specific issues with women that don't occur in men, vice versa. Gender neutral does the same thing, right? And here's an example of the safer use model in practice. So we have this, okay, I want to activate PPAR. That's the pathway, right? We've got all these different pathways. We want to touch this pathway. We want to touch as many pathways as possible before we get to the anabolic side of things or the androgenic side of things, right? So here's one you have available to you. You go, okay, cool. I'll order some cardarine. Hold on, okay? Let's take a step back and work through the model. Number one rule, is it approved for human use? No. Well, then that's it, in my opinion. Many people wouldn't have a problem with this. See the other side of the argument. It failed carcinogenicity testing, which is why it never made it to getting approved for human use. The carcinogenicity testing was on these Hans Winstra rats. They're rats that, anyone that reads a lot of rodent data, they know that everything gives them cancer. they're getting cancer anyway. Like, and a lot of things speed it up. So a lot of people go, oh yeah, who cares if this rat got cancer? Yeah, but the issue is, this is just the basic carcinogenicity testing that these drugs go under. Telmisartan passed the same test. Okay, so if you have a potent PPAR agonist like telmisartan, and you have a potent PPAR agonist like cardarine, one has been approved for human use and is in clinical deployment now. One hasn't. Well, what could be more obvious than that? I could take this one, I don't really know what it's going to do. Or I could take this one and I've got how much data on not only that, but all the other great things that it does. All the other things that we want. It increases IGF-1, reduce your visceral fat. It's going to help moderate your blood pressure. Why wouldn't we, you know, why wouldn't we go that way? So, yeah, for anyone listening that didn't know what telmisartan was, it's that one. It's absolutely my baby in terms of drug deployment, because it's one that I'm trying to push, not like I'm selling it, but I'm trying to get people online in terms of looking at the safe use model like this, because there's so many people that use cardarine. It's crazy because, like, yeah, it does that one thing, that PPAR. Yeah, cool. But it doesn't do all this other cool stuff, and it's also failed the same test. You know, upgrade to the telmisartan, you know?
And that comparison to cardarine was actually the exact reason I brought it up, because the amount of females that I see that have already used cardarine to some form or extent is exactly why I wanted that conversation to be had, plus for them to understand a little bit more about telmisartan. So,
yeah, that's probably a bit of clarity about what cardarine is as well, because a lot of people say, yeah, I'm using this SARM cardarine. It's not, has nothing to do with the androgen receptor. It's not a SARM. Yeah.
Yet it's labeled as one in the community, yeah. which is beyond the conversation we're going to have today. So let's not go down that rabbit hole. So let's kind of talk about, like, the first phases for a female getting into using drugs. Obviously, we kind of touched on telmisartan a little bit. What's the first thing you're looking to use? At what amounts are we using? How are we phasing these people across time? We can discuss the differences between the categories too, and how aggressive that ends up being. But just kind of walk us through, like, scaling for females, because I think that there's these rules of start points that just get put out there, and I don't think it's appropriate. And I just kind of want to discuss the logic behind the phasing.
For sure. Okay, so if you're intelligent and you're patient, which is most important, you will follow things in this way. You will make a single drug deployment at a time. You'll monitor its effects. You'll see what outcome you get. You'll see what trajectory that outcome is on. Maybe research if there's any desensitization or downregulation to that outcome, and then make an informed decision on whether you need to escalate the outcome required. And you can do that via dose or adding another compound in. So let's use telmisartan, for example, because it, you know, very safe, very tolerable drug. If a woman comes to me and said, I want to take telmisartan, I wouldn't be like, oh my God. You know, I'd be like, okay, you know, it's fine. Here's some literature. Very, very common dose deployed is about 80 milligrams in women as well. I tend to use 40 milligrams. With clients. Disclaimer, I'm not a doctor, and whatever other stuff you have to say there. Okay, that's out of the way. 40 milligram is ample, and I want to touch base on this, but someone say, if they use 80 milligram in the literature, what's wrong with that? You know, fair enough. That's, you know, we want to look at deployed dosages. We also want to look at trial dosages. You know, they've escalated. God, I'm trying to remember, something like 300 milligram in some trial data. And it was very tolerable there. Don't quote me on that. But something like it's a really escalated amount. I could find it after the podcast if you were interested in reading it, because I was only on that the other day for a client. But I could say, yeah, you know, you could use 80 milligram, or when we need to escalate, we could go there, or when we need to escalate, we could create a synergy with something else. Or just touch another pathway. Maybe we don't ever need to, you know, just because someone is using a drug at a dose doesn't mean that's your requirement to get to the end goal, you know? So maybe that would just be that one change. Let's, you know, let's monitor something. how is your fat loss going? Do you actually need to take it up a level? You know, if we're talking about fat loss, if it's a gaining phase, you know, whatever, do we need to take it up the level? And then we would just progress to the next pathway and the next pathway, you know, and we just keep working that way.
All right. So then let's kind of like talk about like the stepwise of like past that. What are the next things you're considering typically with most people as we move up the categories? And I know this is very individual, right? And it's going to depend on like past usage, but I just kind of want people to understand like the leveling process of moving across these drugs, like Primo and Anavar, and like where we're, how aggressive are we moving into these, and et cetera.
Yeah. So we're still pretty far away from needing to reach the Primo and the Anavar, you know, so we've pulled the card on the telmisartan. So, you know, this metabolic modulator pathway, right? That's the category of drug. Now we could say, use a catalyst now, you know, use, what's a good example? Injectable L-carnitine. Okay. You could put some injectable L-carnitine in there. Again, completely non-androgenic, has many interesting pathways of activation. We could say, hey, look, we're going to, use this alongside the telmisartan. We use it prior to the training window because skeletal muscle contraction increases the uptake of serum L-carnitine. We could even say, okay, you know, insulin is a tool that we can use to massively increase the uptake of L-carnitine into the muscle cell. Okay, so maybe we could say, here's two drugs that are going to have pretty potent effects in and of themselves, let alone paired in a synergy, both non-androgenic, you know. So we would keep going down these routes here. So now you've got a pretty comprehensive stack. You could say, look, I've got L-carnitine and insulin and telmisartan. There's a lot of people going, insulin? Really? A woman? Yeah. In my opinion, yes. Like, is insulin dangerous? You know, sure, everything is dangerous to some degree. The thing is, the way that the pens are now formulated, you know, I don't know you guys in the States, you can't even get insulin over here that isn't in a preloaded pen. You'd have to take more than one whole pen to even get to the LD50. It's absolutely insane. Oh, what was that case study the other day? I think it was some nurse accidentally injected 5 mL of insulin into a patient. It's a case study. It's on PubMed, but it's quite funny. But even then, you know, how on earth would you ever do that to yourself at home? And they just put him on a glucose drip, you know. The cases of insulin overdose are so few and far between. And most interesting, the cases of people that try to commit suicide using insulin and fail. It's not, you know, children use this drug that are type 1 diabetics, you know. And the doses required to get, let's say, like this pushing of ATP synthesis from L-carnitine, what, 5 units? You know, you're talking nothing. Very, very, not 50 units. That's, you know, what these bodybuilders are using. There's a lot of that, you know, the old Milos Sarchev protocol, whatever that is. That's like 20 units. 5, you know, very low amounts. And we've not even touched androgenicity here. And you got a massive, you know, push on the anabolic side of things. And remember that we said that the amount, the anabolic toll that females require is far lower than a man, right? So we can really take some great benefits here.
So obviously, with that being brought up, the next thing that I know my audience is wondering about is GH, with the question with the insulin brought up. So let's touch on GH real quick before we get into some of the others.
Yeah, I like growth hormone. So anyone that's interested in a super deep dive on growth hormone, I did growth hormone for fat loss and growth hormone for muscle growth on the Muscle Mentors podcast a while ago. But that's like a 2-hour podcast. We go deep, got study references and stuff. I'll give you the long and short of it. Growth hormone for fat loss is an excellent choice for a woman because, again, you're avoiding androgenicity. You're driving this huge super physiological free fatty acid mobilization. And man, like we could even structure a fat loss model for women, you know, under loads of pathways quite easily, you know. I mean, we could even do that for people on here if you want. But let's stick on growth hormone for a second. You've got the free fatty acid mobilization from growth hormone that's going to happen over this, you know, 2-3 hour period. You're pretty much, it's still occurring maybe past 4 hours or something, but you've done the lion's share of it in 2 or 3 hours. Maybe you'd stay fasted in that window. You'd want to, maybe you'd perform some non-glucose intensive activity to get the maximum effect. But, you know, again, here is a drug that's really not offering a great trade-off in negative health outcomes. There are some, you know, any increase in systemic IGF-1 is not a good thing. The higher systemic IGF-1 is directly correlated to lesser lifespan. But the doses required, again, I've actually got another article I'm going to pimp on my website, although it's completely free, so I'm not really pimping anything, is we look at the research on the maximum rates of free fatty acid mobilization, because this is something people like. You know, I wanted to know what's the maximum dose that you can take before you get no more result, okay? Because people want to know what's the most I can take, you know, naturally. Okay, well, luckily for us, there are studies on this. Bearing in mind, this was with intravenous administration, so I'm going to tick it up a little bit for subcutaneous because it's slightly less bioavailable. I did actually work out the differences in bioavailability on that article. Spare people the ramble. It comes out to about 1.5 units per 100 kilo of body weight. So if you've got a female that's maybe 50 kilos, 0.7 units of growth hormone taken potentially, you know, upon waking, do some cardio, stay fasted for maybe 3 hours, you're getting a real potent effect. You know, people say, oh, you know, growth hormone is not that good for fat loss. But, you know, it's a bit an expensive fat burner. Yeah, if you don't use it correctly. Like, the rates of free fatty acid mobilization are huge. Like, I've got a graph on that article that shows the free fatty acid mobilization rates. They're massive. I think the problem is people are not using it in the most efficient way, which is to remain fasted and to perform some activity and just to be in a calorie deficit in general. But yes, that's another one there that is going to drive excellent outcomes, very measurable outcomes. Something like telmisartan and metformin, you're going to feel it, you know, you're not going to necessarily see it. Although I say that, actually, a lot of women I consult with do see a big difference when they take metformin. Usually it's like, you ever have worked with a woman that's got like a pretty poor gut function or poor microbial environment, maybe a bit of that, like not SIBO, but that, like, you know, it's a bit like that small intestinal interstitial kind of swelling. How many times have I seen metformin just clear that up and people go, oh my God, my waist is so tight.
Like, I actually just did that and she lost 4.5 pounds in a week.
Yeah, because exactly. And anyone that's interested on the deep dive on metformin, again, I've got a presentation on my website on it and it's free. But you will see there what it does in terms of the gut microbiome. It's nothing short of incredible, really, which is why I hypothesize it is such an effective anti-aging drug, I think, why we see it in life extension, because that mechanism isn't entirely elucidated, but that would be my guess anyway. But, you know, these aren't drugs that are going to blow your head off. Growth hormone, you will see that change rapidly, you know. So that's where, you know, we're humans, we want to do the craziest shit, you know. People go, yeah, but, you know, telmisartan, that's all good, but I want the anavine, I want to look hard and peeled straight away. You know, you have to make allowances there and say, okay, well, why don't we just try a bit of this first? You know, the non-androgenic. I will say for women, growth hormone is sexually dimorphic in the sense that the IGF-1 secretion that you'll get from growth hormone, endocrine IGF-1, paracrine IGF-1, autocrine IGF-1, is going to be far, far less for women. I would honestly say don't bother. if your goal is hypertrophy as a woman with growth hormone, it's probably not a worthwhile investment. Is it still going to help? Yes, of course. It's going to raise your IGF-1, and that's not all that it does. But if you're clawing for that last 1% as Miss Olympia, yeah, put it in there. You know, otherwise, it's probably not a good risk to reward for you, right?
And for the males listening, I know you and Austin did a podcast about the synergy of growth hormone and insulin as well and its usage with anabolics a long time ago, but it was a good episode. If y'all do want to learn a little bit more about how that works, it's a good one to do, which we can do at a later date. But
okay. Yeah, well, that's quite an interesting one, because it's funny when it's the synergy between growth hormone, insulin, and also testosterone, androgens. You know, you take growth hormone and on its own for growth, you're not getting anything. You know, you have to create the synergy. That's super interesting there. But yeah, you're right. I mean, even something I could say like insulin sensitizes the ERK1 and 2 and the MEK1 and 2 pathways, and they're pathways of anabolism that growth hormone activates. So it's those very slight intricate synergies that make these things work so well together. Insulin increases intracellular growth hormone receptors. It stimulates receptor biosynthesis. You know, so it's these little things, because they're counter-regulatory, you know, you would somewhat expect the interaction, but it's that rather odd situation where they'd both be present.
Yep. Which is exactly why, like, these are the things, like the things you just said, that I don't think are considered when setting out and mapping out stack design for people. There's things that just aren't considered, right? And that's the thing of using things in order to make the most of what you can. And I just think that that's missed, and it's just more nowadays, instead of let's try to understand these drugs to the extent that we can create synergies and get a better effect with less. And that's, you know, and this past time that I pushed up, like, my blood work came back the best it's ever been. And it's like, I'm healthier, I'm growing, I'm getting better. And it's this understanding of how these things work that are benefiting to that. So
yeah,
it's the whole reason we have you on, is because that understanding needs to be across all coaches who are implementing this with their clientele. So, I mean, it's just big reason why we're having you on. So we've covered that step before considering the things like Anavar, MPP, Primo.
I think there's more steps.
Really?
So we've got telmisartan, we've got metformin, we've got L-carnitine, insulin, growth hormone. So we've got 5 drugs of escalation there. You know, that's a long time that you could be working them through. I would even consider clenbuterol here.
Okay. Yeah, I could see that. All right, continue. All right, I'm on board.
There is evidence that clenbuterol phosphorylates mTOR, right? mTORC1. So, you know, to make a long story short, activating anabolic pathways like muscle protein synthesis. Remember what we said about the anabolic toll in women. Clenbuterol, again, approved for human use. Have you heard of the Hatfield protocol? So we got 700 micrograms a day of clenbuterol being used in patients with heart failure. You know, when you say to people, oh, don't take that clenbuterol, it's bad for your heart. Anyway, clenbuterol would be a tolerable deployment here, either for fat loss or for hypertrophy, right? So I would even put that one in there as a consideration that, look, it offers you anabolic benefit. There's a lot of things. It inhibits myostatin to some degree. It increases IGF-1, think synergies, and it also turns on some of that anabolic machinery as well. So in the context of a greater span of drugs, I'm doing things with my hands again. I was doing on the last podcast. Sorry, I realize people are listening. If we have some IGF-1 interaction there, telmisartan pushes up IGF-1. We've got growth hormone in there. We've got insulin in there. You know, you start thinking there's a lot going on. Maybe you don't even need to take the next step, you know. And then talking fat loss, there's quite a few things you know, I don't know if you wanted to focus more on fat loss or hypertrophy, but we've got thyroid hormones, which you could use for fat loss that are non-androgenic. You've got glucose disposal agents, metformin falls in there, but you've also got berberine, catecholamines like caffeine or nicotine. We've done the beta 2 adrenergic agonist. You've got alpha 2 adrenergic antagonist, yohimbine. Mm-hmm. You know, how many drugs have we named now?
Right. And this was kind of like the discussion that I was having beforehand, that there's a lot of things within a fat loss that you can utilize across like people, especially like bikini athletes. Like, how many drugs have we already listed that have already been to be extremely beneficial to fat loss across multiple different pathways, right? Like, people don't think of each of these affecting different ones. That they just like, how many times have I seen a bikini girl come to me on 10 milligrams of Anavar? It's like, really? Like 10. And that's like, really? Like, you have all of these to use before you have to even get here, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just mind-blowing that it's not considered in a fat loss phase. Now, one thing I was kind of wanting to stress too within this is, because we've touched a lot of fat loss, is the hypertrophy side of it too.
Yeah.
Just because for the females that are competing in the bigger classes, like the figure and physique, that's definitely something that's going to be a big consideration. So past the ones we've mentioned, in my opinion, it would be phasing into the little bit of the harder drugs. And I say harder, but you know what I mean. With the, a little bit of the androgenicity tied or associated to it, but very weak androgenicity, but still some associated. So let's touch on use of these once we've made it past these initial phases that we've already discussed.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. I'd be quite interested to talk through this with you in the same way that we did the AI discussion in the last podcast. Let me ask you, as a coach, maybe what would be your first choice in this realm with a woman? Exercise selection, just compound selection wise. We don't have to talk dose or anything like this.
Probably, preferably, if I know they can get very high quality, is low dose Primo.
Yeah. Okay. Why is that?
As long as they can get high quality, which over here is a big problem, is getting Primo that's fake. So it makes me very hesitant depending on where they're getting. The conversation we had last week or last time with, you know, where are you getting your stuff type of a thing. It makes the only thing that makes me hesitant with using Primo. It's just with Primo, there's a lot of things that I think that we're avoiding with using an injectable with Primo relative to using Anavar is the first step, right? Like the first thing that we consider is going to be liver health totals. Still very, very low on the androgenic, moderate anabolism, right? I don't think that I would step in with NPP first. I think that that is something that is very usable in females. But for me, least amount of side effects, least amount of androgenicity, very easy to control, a little bit of a longer half-life, but that's still going to allow me to control what I'm seeing in a result manner and adjust the dosage. Where like a lot of times over here, at least like for Anavar, people will get like 10 milligram tabs and you'll get them tested in like 20 milligrams. And it's like, okay, like this is not helping, right? Like this is putting us down a path that's going to lead to side effects very fast. So, and that's just my preference. I would go Primo first. But I'd be curious to hear what you would do.
Well, is that because of the myotropic to androgenic, like Hirschberger assays?
Yeah. So it's going to be like, and that's my thing is like, so many people go down the Anavar route so aggressively, very fast. And I'm very hesitant to go down that route very fast. Like if I can get quality Primo, just like the anabolic benefit to androgenic, the anabolic to androgenic ratio of Primo, for me, it's a little bit easier to control and I'm still getting a very positive result. And we're driving that protein synthesis, nitrogen retention, everything. And that's just my preferable drug of choice first.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you're off there at all. I think everything you've said is absolutely bang on. The way I'd encourage women to look at their compound selection here would be twofold in the sense that we're ideally looking for the greatest divorce from androgenicity possible. And we're looking for the greatest degree of tissue selectivity possible. So you could look at the Hirschberger assays, which we just mentioned there, which is the classic anabolic to androgenic ratio. These models are very flawed. They're rodent models, firstly, so they're already not going to be the most accurate data. They're measured using the levator ani, which is a smooth muscle. It's not a skeletal muscle. All kinds of problems.
And we can see variants too across drugs. Like you can see, like, for example, I think like Winstraw will test anywhere from like a 1 to 1.
3 to 1 to 30.
To 1 to 30 or 1 to 25, something like that, right?
Yeah.
So that, I mean, there's another issue.
Yeah, same thing with Primo. There's a great crazy variance there. So but then we have phase 3 human clinical trials, right? We should look at that. Because a lot of people say, yeah, use Anavar, because to be honest, on the Hirschberger assay, it looks great. But let's come back to number one rule on the safer use model. Again, like, this isn't scientific fact when I say safer use model. This is kind of just my experience of coaching women and whatnot here, or men. What dosages are used in clinical data with women? Masteron, 300 milligrams. For decades, many women, thousands upon thousands. Anadrol, 150 milligrams a day. Primo, 1,200 milligrams a week. You're looking at this data, something like Masteron is what, I don't know if you'd call this well tolerated, but it's about half women using 300 milligrams of Masteron. So if about 50% of women can tolerate 300 milligram a week, is it sort of fair enough for us to say 10% of that dose would be a very safe deployment, right? So that brings us to 30 milligram a week, right? What about the Anadrol?
Amen.
Let's say about 50% of those women saw off-target side effects. Well, we'd be down to 15 milligrams a day. So you compare that with something like Anavar. Well, sorry, let's take Primo, right? 1,000, that there is a study, because I wrote a paper again. I wrote an article on my website. Sounds like I'm absolutely pimping my website here. Trust me, guys. It's all free. Just do it because I like researching this stuff. But yeah, it's free stuff, and it's all properly referenced and whatnot. So, you know, I'm not just making it up. There is an article I wrote on there. I think I put it under the guise of, like, what's the highest total milligram ever studied? And it was Primo. It was in women. And it was about half of them saw negative side effects. And the dose was, I think it was 1,200 milligrams. So let's say we take 10% of that. We've got 120 milligram a week, right? Now take Anavar, which is the first drug, you know, there was I don't even know who this woman is, but so many people sent it to me last week, Instagram. I can't remember her name. I'm not going to call her out anyway. Hey, look, 5 milligram of Anavar a day is safe for your first cycle or whatever. Or was it 10? I think it was 10 milligram. Yeah. So
it was 10 because you sent it to me.
Yeah. I was like, this is why we need to do this. Now everyone knows I'm an Instagram gossip. anyway, so the dose that's used of Anavar in clinical, in phase 3 human trials with women is 20 milligrams. So if we're following this rule and we say, right, we take about 10% of that, that's 2 milligram a day. 2 milligrams. Like, who's taking 2 milligrams of Anavar a day? So I think Anavar is probably a pretty shitty choice.
And how much anabolic benefit is it providing you at that point? Like, it's not even worth taking, in my opinion.
That's painting the picture of how incorrect that Hirschberger assay is. Because how androgenic is something like Masteron on the Hirschberger assay? In humans, you put it in a human, there's a massive difference between drostanolone and Anavar. You know, a ridiculous, right? Even Anadrol. You know, I bet if you said to some people you take Anadrol in women, they'd think you're crazy. Well, I actually think Anadrol acts quite like an estrogen, but another topic for another day, which is probably why it works quite well in women. But be careful who you're listening to here and what you're looking at is my one point here. We're looking at actually human data. Stay away from this rat stuff. Same thing with like DHB. Whoa, it's like a million times more anabolic than testosterone. No, it's not. You know, like with like comparing trenbolone to testosterone. Hey, look how much more androgenic. No, it's way less androgenic. Ignore this stuff. You know, anyone that tells you trenbolone is more androgenic than testosterone, go somewhere else because it's wrong. It's just completely incorrect. It's not what the data says. Women, this is the, I get quite annoyed at this because this is why women getting coached by men, there's a big problem here. It's just the straight up rhetoric. Yeah, use a bit of Anova. Hold on. You know, just look at what the research actually says. There needs to be some level of pharmacology understanding here. So my actual probably first escalation based on the human data, you'd be surprised by this, probably be osterine.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
It's not as tissue selective as I think people might think, but clearly by the data, it is tissue selective. A dose like 5 milligrams of osterine is going to probably be my first step. Yeah. And then what you've said in terms of Primo, I'd probably graduate to Primo. I would consider exogenous estrogen, maybe prior to a nandrolone deployment or something like this. People don't realize that estrogen is ridiculously anabolic. Like, it is a performance enhancing drug. What estrogen does, and more specifically, in my opinion, estradiol, to the growth hormone IGF axis and the resulting growth factors, localized IGF-1 is huge. You're not going to get this benefit if you're just taking something like Primo. But if we paired up something like Primo that has this huge divorce from androgenicity, and rather than having to use another drug like a testosterone or something, women can use testosterone, by the way, people listening, and they do produce testosterone. It's just very reflective of dose. In fact, most women probably should use testosterone eventually. Another topic, I know, but pairing that maybe with another drug as compared to escalating to something with that lesser divorce from androgenicity. Some of the things that estrogen does is insane. It increases free fatty acid mobilization. It limits visceral fat storage. It reduces appetite. It increases bone mineral density. It increases insulin sensitivity, improves nutrient partitioning. It's going to increase your ability to utilize fat as an energy substrate in low intensity exercise. It's going to reduce protein requirements, likely through its increase in nitrogen retention. It's going to increase storage of intramuscular triglycerides. Women, this for you is important because that's a real key substrate for fuel during resistance training. For men, not so much. Prevents inflammation, reduces free radical damage. That's an important one because of how much oxidative stress we drive. It reduces DOMS. It directly potentiates the remodeling of skeletal muscle. Whenever E2 is at its highest, when women are cycling normally, in any studies, strength and size gains are increased. It's not androgenic. Should have said this before. Can't believe I skipped this one. Like, this is a big deal. So this is kind of thing, again, you know, consideration if you take birth control, you're losing some of that. You know, if you take an exogenous progesterone only, you are pulling down androgens and estrogen, and you're going to lose some of these benefits. My basic recommendation here would be look at the literature. I think actually women are in a very privileged position. God, don't sound clip that in 2020. I'll get in big trouble. in terms of the literature, because there's loads on women because they're the androgen sensitive. That's what we're, no one cares if a man can take 200 milligrams of testosterone. Yeah, he can. Move on. You know, But the research in women, and also an interest in research area is transgender research now. It's quite a bit more of that. And I find that quite useful in terms of here's where women see virilization effects. I want to make one point very clear that in no uncertain terms, if you are a woman taking exogenous androgens at super physiological doses, which you will be, otherwise you'll just be replacing what you're already producing, this is hormonal gender reassignment. There's no two ways about that, that this is a biological fact. I know that sounds a bit out there. It's true, and you have to keep that at the forefront of your thoughts, that eventually you can build an androgen load to the point that you will fully virilize yourself. And you will see all of the off-target side effects. That some of androgen exposure will get there. Your main goal here is to stave that off as much as possible. Let's say you've got let's say your androgen load is 100. I'm just pulling out random numbers. On your first blast, maybe you go to 5, and then maybe you get to 10. You know, look at any woman competitor that's been doing it long enough. It's exposure over time. You're eventually going to get there. What you want to do is limit that as much as possible, using every way. So, you know, picking these drugs that have the greatest divorce from androgenicity, and using the absolute minimum required for the minimum length of time is key. So just like you said, I think I would say Ostarine, but Primo definitely. Nandrolone for sure. You know that there's room for the deployment in there. I mean, it's also an endogenous hormone in perinatal periods and whatnot anyway, so you can make an argument about the bioidentical nature of it there. It does have a large divorce from androgenicity, but there are other issues with nandrolone that make it somewhat less refined, so to speak, than primobolan, in my opinion. The only benefit you'd be getting, because we spoke last podcast about the classical pathway of anabolism, right? The genomic pathway, what it's going to do at the androgen receptor. You're not really getting anything different from nandrolone as you're getting from primo. The protein accretion is going to be the same. What you are getting is a little bit of that estrogen vector. I would probably, if I'm being a bit anal about it, rather just use some exogenous estrogen with the primobolan. And you know, another thing, like you see men doing this now, any men listening to this, I think that's absolute nonsense that people are doing that. I don't know why a man would use exogenous estrogen. You can just take testosterone. Don't worry about it.
Aromatizing drugs that you can use. Like you just don't worry about it. Like it's going to reflect in blood work and elevate as long as you're using the appropriate stack design. And that's one thing I wanted to pull out too, is like the beneficial effects of this. And you wrote a great article on it in Skeletal Muscle on your site too, that I read. It's given this big, like bad, like association. And it's and how many females have you seen come to you using Nolvadex?
Oh man. Yeah. Yeah. All of them that are in prep. Yeah. That's,
and it's like,
I remember reading, I don't know if you've ever followed Chester Rockwell. He's quite a low-profile dude. Me and Chester have been friends for years and years. Most people won't have heard of him. Something that always stuck with me is when he used the word devastating to describe tamoxifen. I've always remembered that. Like, the effects are devastating. And that couldn't be further from the truth. Like, I credit Chester for that. I'll use that word all day. The deleterious health effects of... Because tamoxifen is a bit of a double whammy. Not only are you inhibiting estrogen receptor binder, but it is also an aromatase inhibitor as well, hepatically. God, where is endocrine IGF-1 produced? You know, in the liver. You want to, and this is why we're going to see these big reductions in GHIGF axes activation. God, please, as a woman, you don't ever need this. CIRMs, AIs, please.
Stay away. Please.
You can only blame the education providers, I think. You can only blame the coach. You can only blame... I wouldn't blame any women for doing this. You know, it's not their job to know that. They're paying someone else to do the thinking for them. This is why these podcasts need to get done, you know?
because I don't know what your numbers are, but I'd probably say 7 out of 10 have used it to some extent that I run across, like an Olvidex or anything, or an AI of some sort. And it's just sad to see.
And in bikini, practically every girl that I'll consult with will say, oh yeah, my coach had me using this thing last prep. Not sure what it was. And I'll say, you know, find out what it was. And it's always that. Or Clen or T3, one of those. But yeah, it's, you know, it's a pretty sad state. But yeah, for the women listening that are thinking, yeah, but tell me the good stuff. Like, I'd agree with Luke. I think Prima is a good choice. The only way that I'd maybe be able to offer any more there would be, it does appear that duration, as we said, is the concern. So I wouldn't say, right, I'm going to use, and let's consider androgen load, right? Like X amount of androgens over Y time. Like maybe you require a certain load. Maybe rather than spreading that over 8 weeks, maybe you'd spread it over 4. You know, maybe it'd be just a little bit more aggressive dosing. I hate to say that, but people are going to do it anyway. So if you're going to do it, follow this pattern. You'd maybe use more for less time. And you could even construct that within it a single week. You could say, right, maybe instead of using primobolan enanthate to have these really steady exposure to androgens, maybe I'll use a shorter ester or even like a base. And maybe I'm just going to use it twice a week. Big spike in androgens. You know, and then I'm going to have less overall duration of exposure. I will preface this with, I'm pulling this out of my ass. Like, this is not researched. This is a hypothesis based on findings of literature, right? So they would be, there's some things that I have done with my girls that in my experience has worked really well. I think any coach, even if they're not into the evidence-based thing, they see pretty quick that the duration is an issue. You know, everyone sees this. Funny, in fact, like years ago, I did a podcast with Tom Haynes. I don't know if you know Tom Haynes. He's known as Evolution Coaching in the UK. He is like the guy for prep, like the guy. But he self-admittedly, he don't know any science. You know, he don't care about no PubMed or nothing like that. But I remember him saying, I've just noticed this, you know, because he's smart, he's intuitive. I noticed this in my women. And I was like, oh, okay. That's, you know, he sees it. And it's also what the literature says. That's a smart, smart dude. So I think, you know, people do, you know, that the anecdote is there as well. It's not only in a lab setting. We do see it happening here as well, which is always important. That is part of the learning process of any bodybuilding coach, to actually have the real life application, the in the trenches, so to speak. So yeah, maybe that's how I would phrase it with a woman. You'd say, you know, pick the thing with the greatest divorce from androgenicity at the lowest dose possible. As you escalate dose, remember that tissue selectivity dwindles off. It happens in every single non-steroidal and steroidal SARM piece of literature there is on the planet. And you would have very small, like maybe you do like 4 weeks on, come off, or two. You know, it doesn't have to be 4. 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Come off. Okay, do I actually need more? Well, I'm going to, you know, I'll have 8 weeks off now and, you know, roll in. And another thing I'd say is to remember what we said last week. What do these drugs actually do? Because a lot of women get to prep and then they go, oh, I'm going to go on my Anavar now. What is the worst time to use that? You know, you've now put yourself in a position that you've got the greatest exposure to androgenicity and you haven't even got the substrate availability to drive what this drug's actually good at, which is protein accretion. Like, you're a bikini competitor. What are you trying to do in prep using this drug? Admittedly, yes, nitrogen retention, blood volume, a bit more intramuscular glycogen, triglyceride stuff. Fair enough, but they're fairly acute. You know, you could just use it from 10 days out. You know, you don't have to be doing this 12-week cycle of Anavar, because the returns on investment are going to be ridiculously low and it's adding up your androgen total, creeping up there. Save it for the off season. I've got a lot of female clients that we use no androgens pre-contest, nothing. And I don't have a problem getting them in shape and looking the way that I want them to look. Off season, when we need to put that additional tissue on, that's when we would deploy them there.
And understanding how to apply all these is the big thing that I wanted to come across, which is a great kind of finishing touching point there of like the difference between all season and choosing drugs for all season and contest prep to drive what we're actually trying to drive in the different settings that we have the substrate availability in order to drive it. So as a last kind of a finishing thought, or you got to say something, you need something?
I would say on that, someone sat there going, yeah, but what about maintaining muscle tissue? Firstly, I wouldn't be that worried about maintaining muscle in a bikini competitor. Highly unlikely anything's going to be lost there. You're not at a great risk to reward. And that's not a knock on bikini competitors at all. Trust me, my wife's one. It's just the reality, the physiological fact, you know. My wife got second at the Amateur Olympia last year without needing, no, the year before, without needing androgens, you know. However, yes, okay, let's say that you want to alter that ratio. You want to push up that muscle protein synthesis a little bit. You know, you want that protection in there, fair enough. That's when the SAM, that's when Osterine would be all over it, you know, because this is a very tolerable deployment for the androgen sensitive. That's what SAMs are being invented for the androgen sensitive, for women, for elderly men. You know, put 3 milligram, 5 milligram of Osterine in there. And do you know what is crazy? I was trying to find some 5 milligram Osterine for a client the other day, and I could only find it in 10. It's like, why do we need to, like, it's been researched one, two, three, and five milligram. I'm pretty sure it failed at five, but I can't remember why. Although I think it was a cardiotoxic thing, which probably every androgen would fail these days. So yeah, that would be where you're saying, look, you don't need a hard hitter there. So a little bit of anabolism, that Osterine will sail you through no problem. And again, when is your risk for muscle loss actually going to be there? 3-4 weeks out? Just use it from there. You know, you're all good. You're not at a great risk there. It's non-steroidal. The androgenicity is so low, you're pretty good.
Joe, this has been fantastic. And I think we've laid out the thought process that should be had with coaches, with their female competitors. Because I think that I come across too many people, especially from one specific coach, which I'm not going to name, where I've seen like usage of these drugs in 4 or 5 month spans, which is with a duration piece, like it's just absolutely fucking asinine. And when it comes to competing in this sport in a safer use model, but still doing it to drive the effect of being competitive, this is the kind of conversations that need to be had. Last thing before we kind of log off, top three kind of things that irk you the most with drug use with females that you see. And we've kind of touched on them. I just want to re-highlight them again. Just
say that for me one more time.
What's up?
Say that for me one more time, Luke. Sorry.
Top three things that you see what coaches do with females that irk you the most.
Irk me. I'd like to say nothing irks me. it would probably be the straight up jump to Anavar would be my main thing, because that's just a daily thing that I see all the time. And I do blame coaches for that. It is your ethical responsibility to educate yourself in pharmacology if you're going to be prescribing drug use, essentially. I am literally right before this podcast, I had a call with another coach and his client who was female, and I do quite a lot of these, and the point was he didn't feel comfortable recommending drug use to her because he doesn't feel qualified. Don't feel ashamed about that as a coach. These are things that makes you a better coach, outsourcing. When someone comes to me and they've got some kind of biomechanics thing, I'm all right at biomechanics. I'm not the master. I wouldn't be comfortable talking as an authority on it. I'll say, give Cal Raystrick a call, give Luke Hoffman a call, you know, those guys, and I'll be on the call. God, I sat on a call the other day with Dr. Scott Stevenson and a client. It was only because he fanboys him. It wasn't for a particular reason. But the point is, there's no shame in it. And there's not only no shame in it, it should be actively encouraged within the industry because it's a point of education. You know, coaches, they wake up, they coach, then they go to bed. You need to wake up, coach, learn, have a mentor on many subjects. You know, I'm still learning about pharmacology. I have a few mentors. They're not in the bodybuilding world. They're mostly researchers and things like this right now. And that has to be part of your day that you factor in. It's not just coaching. So yeah, the first, I went on a complete diatribe here. So yeah, the first thing would be the immediate jump to Anova. The second thing that I see all the time is that just do what I tell you to do if you want to win, kind of thing. The women get this all the time. Because in my experience, I consult with a lot of bikini girls. I don't know if that's because my wife, who my wife is, and they look at me, I don't know, look at me through her. I had one yesterday. It was like on a similar, I don't know why I get a lot of bikini girls. But anyway, I'm just like, oh, my coach has asked me to take this drug, but I don't know what it is. And we hadn't ever spoken about drugs before then. That's crazy. You know, don't do stuff like that. Don't say, hey, look, I want you to start taking this Clen. That's what it was. And also the dose he gave was one pill. Like, come on, guys. Like, there's there has to be some consideration in there. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Excuse my language.
That's one, like when people refer to the drug use in milliliters and not in milligrams. Yeah. That fucking drives me crazy.
The best one I ever had, I had a consult with a girl who said, my coach has asked me to take T3. And he says he wants me to take it at the physiological level. I was like, what? Imagine trying to dose the physiological level. Well, what level of inter-individuality is there going to be there? And how do you expect some just normal woman to know what like the average replacement dose of T3 is? Like, imagine writing out a program like dose physiological level. Like, it's just nonsense. But anyway, so yeah, it would be that, like, here, go and take this drug. Oh, we haven't even spoke about drugs or anything. Yeah, but you know, this is what other girls are doing, blah, blah, blah. You know, the conversation has to be there. So that would be two things. Third thing that coaching, was it what coaches do? That was the question, wasn't it? Probably what we spoke about in terms of continued education. Because I did a presentation for the Muscle Mentors on their portal the other day on hormonal birth control. And the issue is that women aren't small men. They're not just smaller versions of us, you know. That's what coaches think they are, you know. That's how most coaches treat women. You know, just give them half of what we're doing, you know. And that goes for the training, the drugs, everything. It's lazy. So educating yourself on the actual physiological differences between men and women is important. Remember that one.
That's huge.
No, that one. Glad I had my mute button on when you said that.
Both have so hard.
And my wife were almost on the floor laughing so hard at that because, oh man.
But it's like a hit home point. Like, it's so true. That's just oftentimes like how it's looked at. And I'm not even in like the drug world, and I see it. Like, I see it like just on the natural side of things, like how people diet women. And so I'm like, it's different.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean,
training, diet, you know, these are all, there's huge sexual differences, especially when it comes to essentially sex steroid hormones that are the difference between men and women, right? Like, the biological difference is this. And then you're putting them in an environment where there's no longer that biological difference. And then you're surprised when the voice deepens, or when you get the massive clitoral hypertrophy, and now they're sat there with a voice like Barry White, and you're going, you know, oh, I didn't, you know, that's normally pretty safe, that 10 milligram of Anova. Yeah, is it? Because the average teenage male produces 70 milligrams of testosterone a week. That's on the top end. And you're taking 70 milligrams of Anova a week. Yeah, I know it's a different molecule, but you know, just factor the considerations there. We're really towing a slim line. You know, if you ever look at that, any transgender research, you know, 80 milligram, 100 milligram a week of testosterone is a very normal amount. That's not miles off what a lot of women use. So, and do it for long enough, even the lower doses, do it for long enough, it's going to add up. So yeah, that last point was coaches don't educate themselves. So to sum up those, not following a kind of escalation through more tolerable, safer, outcome-based drugs. Yeah. Second one, I can't even remember what that was. What was the second one? Don't know, bro. I get so caught up in my rambling.
Reverse back to earlier in the episode and they'll figure it out.
Yeah, whatever I said then, that was number two. Number three was coaches not educating themselves properly. And I would actually encourage people to call their coach on this. Not in any kind of emotional way, but if a client said to me, like, you know, if a female client messaged me, Joe, just wondering what you're like actively doing to, you know, keep up to date with female, maybe literature on new drugs that females are using or something. I'd think that was really cool. I'd be like, this is awesome because this person is invested in their health. And, you know, you're being accountable. Just like if you're at work, you know, maybe you've got targets to hit. If you're being a lazy bastard and you're not doing your job properly, you get fired. That doesn't happen in coaching. The coaches definitely need more accountability is what I'm trying to say here. So I would encourage clients to be on the coach. You know, when it comes to prep, if your coach says, here, start taking some Anavar, you say, look, I've got no problem taking that Anavar if that's what you think I should do. But I'm just interested in, you know, maybe break this down for me. Why have you chosen that dose? Why have you chosen that as compared to another compound? How long do you plan us to run this dose for? What are the actual, you know, effects that we're looking for? What should I expect? You know, and if your coach says to you, look, how many of my clients have won shows or two, I say, go somewhere else. You know, because that coach should be making the effort to provide the information for you.
Yep. Yeah, which is a big part of the process. Every person that's considering this, I schedule a consult call for an hour to go over the positive outcomes, negative outcomes, why we should be doing this, what would we be doing it for, et cetera, et cetera. It's just so that they're informed before that decision's made. But Joe, you've been fucking fantastic. I think that this will not be the last time we'll be talking to you. I'd love to do more of a back and forth episode possibly with Matt asking questions of like case studies where we kind of go through how we would manage some of these situations just to compare and contrast how we're managing it. I think
I really like when we do that, when we kind of discuss what you do and me, because I'm quite curious on what people do.
Definitely. I think it would be very applicable to the audience of like understanding that, you know, probably the way that we manage these things aren't too far apart. Maybe the progressions are a little different, but it's probably along the same thought process and mindset, and then understanding what's going on is driving these thought processes. So I'm pretty sure the audience would like that. So we'll try to get that scheduled in the next few months too.
I'd like to see y'all do like a case study. Like, let me draw up a client.
Yeah,
you two go back and forth with like how you would do things and like, okay, if it progresses here, how would we go? Because I think that's something that like is number one. It's good for like clients to hear. Like, if you're a competitor, it's good to hear. Like, oh, okay, so they went here, but my coach went here. Why did my coach go here? And like, and it's just starts that conversation of like you're informed now. But it's also good for coaches to hear those type of things. So yeah. I think it'd be kind of neat just to have like, you know, a like, you know, female athlete, a case study, and then just like, let me draw a female athlete up. I'll come up with some, you know, we'll come up with some like blood work numbers and all that kind of stuff. And then we'll go like, hey, this person is, you know, they won, and they made it, you know, to the next stage where they're going to nationals and they really want to like kill it. Like, what are we doing with the athlete going from, you know, winning this show, being nationally qualified and stepping on the national stage, or, you know, getting into their first show, or, you know, those type of things, I think that would be really, really cool for the audience. And I think you two going back and forth would be great, just because y'all are both like so science minded, but it's also like on the PED side of things, which we just don't get a lot of, you know, so.
Yeah, I think, that's exactly it. I can't say I've ever seen someone do that, but if I think of me 10 years ago, I'd have loved to have that, you know, but that would be sweet, dude. Yeah, I think people would love that. Yeah, so happy to do that anytime, guys.
100%.
All right, Joe. You've been fantastic. Matt, wrap us up. You can find all those stuff all on Instagram. His website's fucking fantastic. So, Matt, wrap us up.
Yeah, y'all go check Joe out, joejeffreycoaching.com. He's also Joe Jeffrey Coaching on Instagram. But yeah, if you, the more informed you are when it comes to drug use, the better off you're going to be in the long run. It allows you to make like an informed decision, which, I mean, if you were getting on birth control, I'm pretty sure you'd be informed about it from your doctor. Like it's kind of important when you're putting, you know, performance enhancing drugs in your body. So like
that one, bro.
I don't know. Like, I don't, some people just get on it and just for the, you know, the whole, like, I just don't want to get pregnant type things, but like, it really should be like an informed decision. And the more informed you are, the better decisions you can make, or at least hopefully the better decisions you can make. So, this was a fantastic conversation. You know, women aren't smaller men. We know that now. And I think everyone's just going to benefit from hearing this. So educate yourself if you're a coach, educate yourself if you're an athlete, and make these informed decisions and try and do the best you can to, you know, keep your dosages low and your cycles relatively, I guess, on the shorter side for females is what we kind of went through. So.
For sure.
Yeah.
Sweet. Thanks for having me, guys. It's
absolutely.
Thank you for letting me ramble on, and thank you everybody for listening. And if anybody needs anything, drop me a DM on Instagram. Get back to you as soon as I can. Or if you want a consultation, in fact, I'm closing consultations for the next few months. But you can go on the waiting list if you drop me an email. So that'll be cool.
All right, everyone. Thanks for coming out. We'll catch you in the next one.
Thanks, guys.